Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. That music's a little bit weird, so it must be time for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and likes thinking outside the box about questions maybe you won't get other people to answer. And so we collect up the weird questions. Well, Jimmy does the collecting, collects up the weird questions. And every now and then we get to do a weird questions show on a Friday usually. And we're at it again. Jimmy Akin, welcome.
Howdy, Cy Kellett. How are you doing?
I'm doing very, very well.
So I see you've already wiped off your ashes.
Yes, I have. Yes, I showered. But actually many times because... as people might know, sometimes we pre-record the... Actually, we always pre-record weird questions, right?
No, we don't.
Oh, we do it live sometimes? Oh, all right.
We just don't take calls.
Yeah, but we're pretending that we're here live on the first Friday of Advent, so please don't eat any meat during the show. And off we go. But you do know this because you always seem to know. What's the episode today for February 16th of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Well, today I've got a really cool episode. Last week we did a cryptid hunt and we looked at the Beast of Gévaudan, which was a terrifying animal that terrorized parts of France for several years in the 1700s. And it was a very scary thing. It involved me having to read a lot of bloody accounts of what the beast did to people. And after that, I thought, I want to do something happy with animals, you know?
Okay, yeah.
I want to do something that, you know, like about pets and how much they love us. And so this week, we have an episode on pet telepathy. And there have been many, many people who have reported that their pets anticipate, for example, their returns. Like the dogs especially. Cats do it to some extent, but dogs do it more. Where like 5 minutes before the person comes home, the dog just gets up and goes to wait for the owner, no matter what the dog was doing previously. And there have been controlled scientific studies on this where they have eliminated time of day. So it's not the time of day that tells the animal when to go to the door. They'll have people come home at random times. It's not the vehicle that the person is coming home in. They'll have the person, you know, walk or take someone else's car or come on a bus or things like that. And this happens even when no one in the household knows when the person's coming back. So they can't be signaling the animal.
Oh, yeah, right.
When the person's coming home. And so and what you do in a controlled scientific experiment is you eliminate all of the other possible factors you can think of. And they've done that. And yet a substantial percentage of pets, especially dogs, will anticipate when their owner is coming home. And we're going to have video footage in the video version of the podcast of that happening. Also, though, some animals, you know, dogs and cats can't really talk. They can make noises, but they don't have they can't make words the way we do. But some pets can, like parrots.
Oh, yeah.
And there are parrot owners who have taught their parrots how to talk and even they're not perfectly grammatical, but form their own sentences. You know, so this is not just repeating what they hear other people say. A trained parrot has a linguistic ability comparable to a 2 or 3 year old human. And there have been parrot owners who have reported, my parrot seems to know what I'm thinking because I'll be thinking about something. And even though I don't say it out loud, my parrot vocalizes what I was just thinking. And so they tested that too. And we're going to have video footage of split screen where you see what the owner is doing and what the parrot is saying in separate rooms. And the owner is like looking at, as part of the experiment, they're looking at photographs, you know, for 2 minute intervals. And then they're recording what in a different room the parrot is saying. And so you'll have the owner looking at a picture of a flower. And the parrot, whose name is Nkisi, is saying things like, oh, that's a pick of flowers. You've got to get pick of flowers. Why don't you get a camera, pick a flower?
Wow.
And then she'll look at a picture of a guy talking on a phone, and the parrot starts making answering machine noises. and then says, "What you doing on the phone?" And
that's wild.
And then she looks at a picture of a couple in bathing suits walking down a beach, you know, mm-hmm. and so they're showing a lot of skin. And the parrot says, "Look at my pretty naked body. Look at my pretty naked body."
Weird. That's so weird. Well, that will be a palate cleanser from the murderous French beast.
Yes.
That's very nice. All right. Psychic animals. That dropped this morning, as a matter of fact, on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Mysterious.fm is where you can find it, or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on your computer and it'll bring it to you. If you so they got to go to YouTube if they want to see the video.
Yeah, YouTube.com/Jimmy Akin.
All right. It's time for some weird questions. And this we'll start with Jennifer. Jennifer asked this. If someone died and went to purgatory, did their time and went to heaven, but their family had them frozen using cryonics, and 1,000 years later, technology was able to, quote, bring them back, would they have to redo their time again in purgatory after they died again based on current sins? Or would their reliving and dying again really mean they never died and would be dying for the first time and everything had to start over, purgatory time, et cetera?
Okay, well, if someone dies and gets their body is reanimated 1,000 years later, I'm going to say that's real death. So I don't think it's that they didn't really die. No, I think you really died. Another possibility that Jennifer doesn't name is that they came back to life after 1,000 years and they didn't develop any new disordered desires, and so they wouldn't need to go through purgatory again. The way the church currently articulates its teaching on purgatory, its purpose is to free us from disordered desires that we have, which would hold us back from being able to be fully loving and so mm-hmm. forth in heaven. And so so that's a possibility that needs to be considered if you've done your time and had all your disordered desires purged. The truth is, of course, that nothing like this has happened, and so we don't really know the answer. It could be that when the body gets reanimated, it might have a new soul. If your soul went off to heaven and got ensconced in heaven, well, it could have a new soul, and that new soul might have disordered desires that need to be purged. Or it could be that the original soul comes back, and when that happens, it might develop new disordered desires that need to be purged after its new life. Or it could be that it doesn't develop disordered desires and so doesn't need to be purged all over again. The weirdest of those to think about when you first encounter it is, you know, the idea of how could a different soul come back? You know, or how could a different soul be in someone's body? But our souls are not uniquely tied to the matter in our bodies. And, you know, we have matter constantly moving in and out of our bodies. And so God can resurrect us with whatever matter he chooses. But in this case, you've got a body. It's been dead for 1,000 years. The soul is you know, in heaven and has been there for 1,000 years. How do you know, and given the extensive repair work that would have to be done on a 1,000-year frozen body, how do you know you're not modifying the body enough that it's not the same body anymore? Mm-hmm. If it's not the same body anymore, if it's like kind of a Frankenstein, then you would have a new soul. Yeah. If it's a new body, it might be based on someone's previous body, but you could have cannibals eat somebody and incorporate matter for their bodies. You could have Dr. Frankenstein stitch together a new body out of multiple bodies. And if it's not a direct survival of a previous body because of how much it's been modified, it might have a different soul.
Oh. All right. The Dr. Frankenstein option. Thank you very much for the question, Jennifer. That is a weird question. I appreciate that. Starting us off with the truly weird one on Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We're going to take a very quick break. We'll come back with more weirdness right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Each weekday, we'll dive into the timeless teachings of our Catholic faith, drawing upon the wisdom of the ages to navigate the challenges of today. Together, we'll seek truth, find inspiration, and forge a deeper connection with God. I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, and I invite you to join me for Beacon of Truth, Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. So if you gave up fun for Lent, you got to turn off the radio now because this is a fun episode that we do. Let me just invite you once again to come to the Catholic Answers 10th Annual Conference. Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Plan to be with us September 26th through 29th as we welcome some of the nation's most brilliant, eloquent, and engaging Catholic speakers as they share the good news of Jesus Christ and His Church. Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn will be there. Dr. Ray Guarendi will be there. Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check will do the radio show live from there. All your favorite Catholic apologists will be there. And we've arranged a very special room rate of $175 a night at the Hyatt. So use the promo code EARLY to save $50 off your conference ticket. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com for tickets and hotel accommodations. Use that promo code EARLY when you go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. Jimmy, this next question comes from a fan of Mysterious World. Lloyd says, I am a 12-year-old fan of Mysterious World from Baltimore and was listening to your recent episode on near-death experiences with my dad. For a Weird Question episode, I would like to know which near-death experience type is the Christmas Carol story by Charles Dickens. Thank you very much.
Okay, so as folks will know, a Christmas Carol involves Ebenezer Scrooge, who is a miserly older man. And at the beginning of the story, he's visited by an apparition of his former business partner, Jacob Marley. And Jacob Marley is in chains, and he's clearly suffering. And he warns Scrooge that he needs to change his ways. He needs to become a more loving, generous person, or he's going to experience the same fate that Jacob Marley is experiencing. Now, I haven't read the novel, A Christmas Carol. I've, of course, seen many adaptations of it, but I haven't read the novel. And it's not clear to me whether Marley is in purgatory or in hell. It could be either one. But in any event, he's in some kind of negative state in the afterlife, so he's having a distressing afterlife experience like the ones we talked about in that episode, and he shows up to warn Scrooge that he needs to change his ways. He also tells him that he's going to be visited by three ghosts: the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas future. So there is actually four apparitions in the course of the story. With regard to the first one, since we know Jacob Marley in the universe of the story was a real individual, this would be what's known as a visitation, which is an encounter. It's a form of after-death communication, or ADC, where someone is in contact with you, usually shortly after they die. And sometimes in visitations, you get information like about something that's going to happen in the future that you need to be warned about. And that's what happens with Scrooge in this. He's given a warning about the future. If you don't change your ways, you're going to end up like me. And And also you're going to be visited by these three other ghosts. There's a term for that. It's not always used in parapsychology, but when you have a warning in Latin, monitum means warning. And so these are sometimes called premonitory experiences. They're like early warnings of something that could happen later. So if I were classifying what Jacob Marley did, I would say it was a premonitory visitation. Then we have the other three apparitions that occur. An apparition is when someone appears, you know, could be to sight, could be to the other senses. In the case of Scrooge's apparitions, they appear to all of the senses, apparently. You know, he can see them, hear them, in some cases touch them and things like that. So what are the three ghosts of Christmas? Well, the term ghost just means spirit. So these would be the three spirits of Christmas. What kind of spirits might they be? Well, your first thought might be human, but there aren't really any humans that embody Christmas, not on different years. So like a past ghost, a present ghost, and a future ghost being three different people. So what else might they be? Well, they might be angelic spirits, meaning created spirits that were never physically embodied. So it could be that God has, you know, in this fictional universe, that God has created angelic spirits that represent Christmas. There's also another possibility, which I'm sure Charles Dickens may have had it on his mind map. I don't know. But they could be what are sometimes referred to as thought forms or tulpas. This is a concept that's discussed in some Eastern religions and Eastern influenced religions. But basically the idea is living humans could, or someone else, you know, God, but living humans could think about something enough that their thoughts take on an independent form. And that's why they're called thought forms. In Tibetan Buddhism, if I recall correctly, I believe it's Tibetan Buddhism, they're called tulpas. And the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future do seem to embody, you know, the Christmas of the past, the Christmas of the present, and the Christmas of the future. So they might be thought forms that are generated, perhaps by living human beings or perhaps by someone else.
Oh, Lloyd, I hope that was helpful to you, a 12-year-old fan of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and look forward to getting more questions from you in the future, perhaps. This one comes from Curtis. Curtis says, my fiance, who loves the show as well, and I were sitting down to dinner and discussing who would get up to get a cannoli. Just get up and get the cannoli. If it's a cannoli, get up. Naturally, the conversation led to this question. Naturally, imagine a gargantuan humanoid being who was 50 million light years from head to foot. What would this creature's experience? What would this creature experience when it, say, scratches its head? Since nothing can move faster than light, would such a simple action take 50 million years? Would time be behaving differently for his feet and his head since they are so far apart?
So I think it could be helpful to think for just a moment about the size of this being, because the Milky Way galaxy itself is only like 100,000 light years across. And so 50 million is way bigger than the Milky Way galaxy. In fact, even the Andromeda galaxy, which is the nearest big one to the Milky Way, it's way less than 50 million light years away. So this is a multi galaxy size spanning being.
Right.
Now, when it comes to time, it's not that time would move different at its head and at its feet because of their distance. Distance itself doesn't really influence time. What does influence time is, or one of the things that influences time is mass. And so this would be an absolutely massive being, assuming it has the normal body density of, say, a human, you know, which is a little bit more than water. Okay, so if it has mass, if this being has mass, it's going to have a center of mass. And that center of mass is going to be midway, if it's humanoid, it's going to be midway between its head and its feet. And so, being in a gravity well where there's more mass, that slows down the passage of time. So actually, if this being is eating cannoli, then the cannoli would enter in the head and travel to down towards its stomach at the center of mass, and time would slow down towards the center of mass because of all of the extra mass of this creature being there. Time would actually run the same at its head and its feet, but in the center of its body, where the mass is, where the center of mass is, time would slow down. So you would find time dilation effects happening in a being of this nature. But there's another issue which also should be mentioned, which is that if this has normal human body density, it's gonna weigh so much that it's gonna have its own gravity attracting it and compressing it into a sphere. So it's not gonna look like a humanoid for very long. I mean, you might create it as a humanoid out of nothing, but then its gravity is gonna start contracting it into a sphere. That's the reason that planets are oblate spheroids, because once the mass of a body exceeds a certain threshold, the gravity will tend to pull the extremities of that body in when it becomes massive enough, it forms a sphere. That's why larger moons are spheres, like our moon, our sister planet, the moon, and Saturn's moon, Titan. But tiny little moons, like Mars's Phobos and Deimos, are lumpy because they're not big enough to be rounded by gravitational forces. And there's another issue, which is that when you have enough matter compacted into a sphere, and we've got tons of matter here, because remember, the original size of this thing was 50 million light years, way bigger than entire galaxies. It's going to collapse and become a black hole. And so it would be really hard to have a humanoid being this large and not have it collapse and become a black hole, unless we change the laws of physics so that that can happen. Well, okay. If that's the case, then in the split second before it starts collapsing, how long would it take to scratch its head? Really can't say, because if we're changing the laws of physics, one of the laws of physics that might change is the light speed limitation. And if that's the case, it wouldn't take 50 million years or any other extended amount of time to scratch its head. It might be able to scratch its head faster than light.
Curtis, it does seem like a natural question to flow from the discussion about getting up to get a cannoli. That's a, I just like that question. That's a good question. I would like to meet Curtis and his fiance. First of all, they eat cannolis. Second of all, awesome questions. Thanks, Curtis. This one comes from Tim. Have you heard of the third man syndrome? Do you think these are angelic beings, or figments of the imagination, or something else? I've never experienced it myself, but it sure is interesting.
Well, I'm glad, Tim, that you've never experienced it yourself, because the third man syndrome, which I am familiar with, is normally reported to occur in life-threatening situations. It's, for example, and I will be covering it on Mysterious World in the future. It's reported, for example, with hikers who have, like, gotten lost in the wilderness, or with divers who have gotten lost in caves underwater, or with people who are mountain climbers who are up at altitude. And what these people have in common, one of the things, is they're in a life-threatening situation. You know, they may die in the wilderness, they may die on a snowy mountaintop, they may die when their air runs out in an underwater cave. And as they're in this desperate situation, they sense a presence. And this presence helps them in some way. It may give them comfort or inspiration that things are going to be okay. It may even give them information. In terms of what the third man could be, well, it's possible that it's the imagination of the people in these desperate situations. It's also possible that it's their imagination drawing on psychic functioning to learn what's the way out of this cave. It also could be departed spirits, like loved ones who are still watching out for you. It could be angels. It could be God. It's really hard to say. The third man, when he shows up, tends not to give a lot of information about himself, although sometimes people have impressions of what the third man is like. But it's a very interesting subject, and I'll be covering it in the future on Mysterious World.
Tim, thank you very much. Any chance that it's aliens or demons?
Well, there's always a chance.
All right.
Demons, though, won't tend to help you.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Unless they've got some sneaky up, like trying to rope you into worshiping them or something. Tim, thank you for that third man syndrome question. A lot more weirdness to come. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin is our topic. And there's the weird music. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carla Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carla's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this first Friday of Lent. I hope you are having a wonderful Lent so far. And I find it difficult. Personally, I find Lent difficult, so I hope your burdens aren't too heavy. This is a good question Joe has. It's very brief, first of all. And I think the answer must be because they're delicious. I think that's my, but we'll see. Joe's question is this, Jimmy. Why do demons prefer pigs?
Well, we don't really have evidence that they prefer pigs. I guess there are horror movies where demons do things with pigs, but those horror movies are just imagination. In terms of what's informing the imagination and what Joe may be thinking of here is the exorcism of the Gadarene demoniacs that occurs, for example, in Matthew and in Mark. And in that story, there's no evidence that demons prefer pigs. What they prefer is humans. They're in these two Gadarene demoniacs, and they're tormenting them, and Jesus is going to kick them out. And they don't want to go to the pit, you know, where they're going to be tormented until the last day. They don't want to go there, but Jesus isn't going to let them torment a human, which is what they really want to do because it's what they've been doing. So instead they say, hey, there's this whole herd of pigs here. Can we go into them instead? And Jesus lets them. And so the pigs are not something the demons prefer here. They're just a backup plan. They'd rather go into the pigs and torment them than go to hell and be tormented there themselves.
Joe, I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you very much for that weird question.
You know, last season on Strange New Worlds, there was an episode, Star Trek Strange New Worlds, there was an episode where it's not a transporter accident, but it's kind of like one. Spock's Vulcan genome gets edited out of him for an episode.
Oh, yeah.
So he's like fully human. And he's still got all of his Vulcan memories, but he's got the biology and more of the impulses of a human. And he's hanging out with Captain Pike, who's cooking bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And Spock just starts chowing down on the bacon.
Yeah.
You know, it's like rapidly. And Pike is like, Mr. Spock, maybe you want to ease up on the bacon a little bit. And he says, maybe you want to slow down a little bit. And Spock says, slow down. I'm making up for lost time.
I have to say, though, for First Friday in Lent, we've discussed cannolis and bacon now. I mean, we're making it hard on people.
You can have cannolis on a Friday in Lent.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Joel.
Unless they're bacon-wrapped cannolis.
Oh, come on. That sounds so good. I wonder if there's anyone. No, I got to stop thinking about this. All right, Joel. This question comes from Joel's 10-year-old. How would the world change if we could teleport?
Well, it would depend on how easy it is to teleport. If it's really hard to teleport, then the world wouldn't change that much. But if it's easy to teleport, you know, like it is on Star Trek, well, then people would get from one place to another much easier and quicker than they do now. You know, we wouldn't, for example, need airplanes or ships or trains or cars or bicycles to go anywhere. We could just teleport to wherever we wanted to go and we would arrive instantly. And so could our cargo. So we wouldn't need, you know, planes and trains and trucks and things like that to move goods to market. You know, you wouldn't have to have like those big, you know, 18 wheelers rolling stuff up to Walmart. You could just teleport the stuff wherever it needed to go. And that would have the effect of increasing the efficiency of our economy, because you wouldn't have to pay for all of that transportation, and you wouldn't have to have people waiting for the goods to show up at market. In fact, you wouldn't have to pay for delivery, because they could just beam it to your home. And so it means that we'd be able to do business without a lot of transportation to and from different places. And that means, because our economy is more efficient, that prices would go down, because you don't need to pay for all that transportation anymore, assuming teleportation is, you know, basically free and easy. Now, that means some people would be put out of work, because if you're a truck driver or an airplane pilot, nobody needs you to do those services anymore. But the way they look at that on Star Trek is people are freed up to do other things. And so, you know, people could transition from one job to another, which is actually, you know, the way that it's always historically been. You know, before we had cars, we needed a lot of people to care for horses, because we used horses for transportation. So you need horse breeders, you need horse grooms to care for the horses, you need people to build barns to put the horses in, you need people to grow hay and harvest the hay and bring it to the horses so they could eat it. And all those jobs went away when we got automobiles. But then the people who used to care for horses, they transition to new types of jobs, like building cars and building gas stations and things like that. So whenever you have a new technology, it causes what's sometimes called creative destruction in the economy. There's a destruction, like some of these old jobs are going to go away, but it's creative because there are new opportunities that are opened up. And the same thing would happen if we got a cheap and easy teleportation technology. There also would be risks that we would have to deal with. Because if you have teleporters, especially ones like on Star Trek, where you can just teleport to anywhere, you don't need a receiver, you know.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's not like
right.
It's not like a telephone. You don't need a receiver on each end. You can, you, if you've got a teleporter device, you can just beam people wherever you want to go. Well, you know what you could do with that? Beam a bomb to wherever they are. So there would be new security risks, and we'd have to figure out a way how to deal with those security risks, because if, you know, terrorists got their hands on a bomb, they could beam it anywhere they wanted, and we wouldn't be able to catch them unless we develop a counter strategy to deal with those things.
Thank you for that question, 10-year-old, Joel's 10-year-old. I appreciate that. I'm going to get to work on my field damper so that people can't teleport bombs to my house. Chase wanted to know this. Do we all share one intellect, as the philosopher Averroes claimed?
Averroes.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, his name in Arabic is like Ibn Rashid, but in Latin they called him Averroes. This is an idea that gets explored periodically. In fact, recently I read a book by a researcher named Larry Dossey who proposes something kind of like this, although even he doesn't go so far as to say we've all really got one intellect. I find the claim very implausible. And for several reasons. The first one is some of us clearly know things that other people do not. You know, I know, for example, what I've got in my refrigerator. I'm pretty sure Cykelet doesn't, not with any degree of specificity.
I know cannolis and bacon. Other than that, I have no idea.
Not in my fridge.
Oh, okay.
No cannolis. Similarly, I don't know what's in Cykelet's fridge. So I know things Cykelet doesn't. Cykelet knows things I don't. And that would suggest that Cykelet and I have different intellects. We've got different minds. But you might say, well, okay, maybe the intellect is something that operates on a different level than simply bits of knowledge. You know, you could say, well, I have different bits of knowledge and Cy has different bits of knowledge. But that's kind of like, you know, if you've got a spreadsheet on a computer, I mean, Cy and I could both be using the same spreadsheet, you know, and like we could both be using Microsoft Excel, let's say, and we just fill in the data differently in my version, but we're still using this common application. We're both still using Microsoft Excel. So what about the idea of us? We could vary in terms of what specific items of knowledge we have, but we might be running the same basic application on a deeper level, and that could be the intellect we share in common. Yeah, so there's some problems with that too. This is the second of my major problems with this idea, which is that some people just seem smarter than others. And I'm not going to make a comparison here between any two particular people, but
I like cannolis.
Cannolis are fine.
Okay.
But you know, some people are smarter than others, and that would suggest they're not simply running the same application. And so whether you conceive of intellect as involving, particular bits of knowledge, some people obviously have different knowledge, or whether you're thinking of it in terms of mental ability, some people have more mental ability than others. And therefore, in terms of both content and ability, it seems like our minds or intellects are different. That's not to deny that they might not be networked. There might be some kind of network connecting our minds, even telepathically. And that's one of the things that Larry Dossey was writing about. But they do appear to be different minds. And for further discussion of all that, I'd refer you to St. Thomas Aquinas's Critiques of Averroes.
That was, let's see, who was that? I'm sorry, I forgot who that was. That was not Joelle.
Chase.
That was Chase. Okay, Chase. Thank you very much for that question. We are up against the break, so we will take that break. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin continues on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
EWTN offers listeners and viewers the daily readings to enable you to accompany the Mass of the day. Our Catholic daily readings include the readings of the day, along with online videos. It's a great resource for all who desire to live a life of faith that is pleasing to our Lord. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having a little bit of fun on this Friday. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. People send Jimmy weird questions, and I think you've developed a reputation of being open to the full range of possible questions, Jimmy.
Well, that's how it got started.
Yeah.
It used to be on just open forums. People would call and ask questions, and no matter what they ask, I'd treat it seriously.
Yeah.
I wouldn't scoff at them or make them feel bad or anything. I'd answer it straight. And they started saying, let's test the limits of that. And
yes.
So right. I would continue to answer the questions straight, and it started doing that. And then that led us to create the Weird Question Show.
Yep. And boy, do they pour in. We get a lot of weird questions for Jimmy Akin. So much so that sometimes, like, we have guests on and they get a question and they go, that's a question for Jimmy Akin. If it's weird enough. Arthur asks this. If a priest says something about confessions he hears as a whole, like, all I ever hear are nothing burger confessions, is that breaking the seal of confession?
No, it wouldn't be. For the seal to be broken, both the penitent and the penitent's sins must be revealed in a way that that it's clear who confessed to what. So let's say I'm a priest, I could say, Cy Kellett came to me for confession. That is not breaking the seal because I haven't revealed anything about what Cy Kellett said. Or I could say, someone came to me and confessed gluttony with cannolis.
Oh, come on.
and that would not break the seal because I haven't revealed who confessed gluttony with cannolis.
Mm-hmm.
It would break the seal, though, technically, if I said, Cy Kellett came to me for confession and someone confessed gluttony with cannolis. Now, I haven't technically said Cy Kellett confessed that, but you can tell based on the context that I'm implying Cy Kellett confessed that sin. And as soon as a reasonable person can make the inference, this person confessed that, the seal has been broken. And then if I said Cy Kellett confessed gluttony with cannolis, that would be obvious slam dunk, over the top, breaking the seal. But the real threshold is, would a reasonable person be able to infer that this individual confessed to that sin? If a reasonable individual can make that inference, regardless of how the information is communicated, it doesn't have to be speech. It could be in some other way. I could say, someone confessed gluttony with cannoli to me, and I'm pointing at Cy Kellett.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. That's, I'm using a gesture to communicate the information. As long as the information is communicated, this person confessed to this, the seal has been broken. So if a priest says, all I ever hear are nothing burger confessions, that would not break the seal. because you have no idea what was confessed. All you know about it is its low order of magnitude in terms of sin. You know, because if someone was like confessing murder, that would not be a nothing burger. And you have no idea who has made these confessions. So you can't link any specific sin to any specific penitent. Having said that, though, there are, in addition to the seal, there are other regulations regarding what priests are or are not supposed to say regarding confession, because you don't want, and how they're allowed to use information. Basically, they're not. If they learn something in confession, they're not allowed to use it outside of confession. So they can't like make decisions, hiring decisions, let's say, based on what they heard in confession. If you're a priest and someone confesses to you, "I habitually steal from my employers," and then they apply for a job at your church, you are not allowed to let your knowledge from confession influence your hiring decision. You have to make the effort to put aside what you learned in confession and make the hiring decision exclusively based on what you know outside of confession. But even then, you know, there is a desire to be pastorally sensitive and not cause undue anxiety among the faithful. Like, did he just break the seal, or is he about to break the seal, and might he break the seal on me? And so priests do need to tread pretty lightly in this area, and there have been additional regulations surrounding the seal. But just saying, "All I ever hear are nothing burger confessions," that does not break the seal.
Okay, thank you very much for that question.
You had, during the break, you were mentioning a particular American churchman who had an interesting saying. Why don't you relate that story real quick?
Yeah, Fulton Sheen apparently said that hearing confessions in the convent was like being pelted with popcorn. And I think that doesn't break the seal.
Better than other things you could pelted with.
You know, that thing about this just priests generally not discussing confessions. I've been around priests my whole life. I don't ever, even bad priests. I've been around bad priests. I mean, we all have if we've not been around priests your whole life. I've never heard a priest even come close to anything that I thought would be revealing of anything in the confessional. I hope people feel secure in that, because it's certainly, priests seem to take it very seriously. We got time for this. Jenny. Jenny wants to know this. Can you help me refute the serpent seed theory? My parish Bible study leader claims Eve was seduced by Satan, and that was the real original sin, that Cain literally was fathered by Satan, and that his children are the bad people of the world because Satan is literally their father. He also says that Cain and Abel were fraternal twins by different fathers.
Well, there's a bunch there, and it's not all directly the serpent seed theory, but one thing that is flatly wrong in what you were told is that that original sin was a sexual act, especially between Eve and the devil. That is not what original sin is. The church's understanding of original sin is that it was an event that's depicted in Genesis as our first parents eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's what it is. It's not a sexual act. And so so that's one problem. Another problem is that Cain and Abel are not twins. If you read Genesis 4, which discusses their births, Eve first has Cain, and then she has Abel, and they are not twins. They are just brothers. And I should say, it is true to give this theory its due credit. Jesus does refer to his opponents as children of the devil. You know, he does that, for example, in John 8:44, but you have to ask, is that a metaphor or is it literal? It would be really bizarre and basically impossible for all of the bad people in the world to be descended from the devil. Because then if you have a given family line that has demonic ancestry in it, and it intermarries with another line, then there's some degree of demonic ancestry there, but you've got good and bad people in the same families. So you can't link being good or being bad to a particular heritage. So that's a problem. But here's the big one for the serpent seed theory. Genesis indicates Adam was the father of Cain. He's his biological father. If you read Genesis 4:1, chapter 4, verse 1, here's what it says. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife. And this is knowing in the biblical sense. The verb in Hebrew for to know is used to mean sexual intercourse between married people. There are other verbs that also get used in Hebrew that are for other kinds, or at least can be used for other kinds of intercourse. Like if it says, so-and-so went into so-and-so. Okay, that's a more graphic way of saying it in Hebrew. If you say he went into her, it doesn't, the Hebrew image is not like he went into her tent. It's more physical than that. So it's because it's more physical, it's more explicit, it's more crude. But if you are referring to married love between a husband and a wife, you say he knew her. And that knowledge, intimacy that's associated with marriage. And so it says, now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. Okay, that tells us what we need to know right there. Adam had marital relations with Eve, and she got pregnant and had Cain. So that tells us who Cain's father is. It's Adam. There is nothing in here about the serpent. The serpent exits stage left after he gets cursed in chapter 3. This is all about what happens after that. And it's clear that the biblical author means us to understand that Cain's father is Adam, that Adam fathered Cain. Also, Eve then says, I have given birth to a man with the help of Yahweh. So she's crediting this, you know, to Yahweh's help, you know, allowing her as a woman to give birth to this new man, Cain. And it would be weird for her to say, I've given birth to a man with the help of Yahweh, if Cain was half demon. So there's just nothing here plausible about the serpent seed theory. Also, I should note that this theory is associated with racism. It was used in the 19th century to denigrate various groups of people. It has been connected with the Christian identity movement, the Ku Klux Klan, and American Nazism. If I were you, I'd find a different Bible study, because whoever your Bible study leader is displaying remarkably bad judgment on how to interpret the Bible here. And now you said this is happening in your parish. So if this is happening in a Catholic church, I would talk to this person and say, this is a serious problem. And if you don't get satisfaction, I would take it up the chain of command and talk to the pastor, because this kind of teaching should not be disseminated in a Catholic church.
Jenny, thank you very much for the question. I'm sure that was helpful to you, and I hope that there'll be something, this will help you address that. So racists would say that, like, people with darker skin were sons of Cain or something? Is that the idea?
Or Jewish people or other people. You also have racist theories connected with Noah's sons.
Oh, yeah.
They'll try to say, you know, like people of African, of sub-Saharan African descent or descendants of Ham.
Yeah.
Who is one of Noah's sons. None of these theories are good and well-grounded.
Again, Jenny, thank you very much. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We got lots more weird questions to come. There's a little bit of the weird music that I like so much. People send these weird questions because they know that Jimmy will answer them. We gather them up and we make an hour or two out of them, and 2 hours of weird questions today. I will invite you again. Come out to our conference. Check it out at CatholicAnswersConference.com. And if you sign up, use the promo code EARLY and you save $50 off your conference ticket. The conference is September 26th through 29th out here in sunny San Diego. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.